And welcome to another episode of Emotion Put Into Measure. I am Richard, and this is Alex, and today we would like to showcase some A.F. Moritz, specifically his early poems. And I offer first some content in the forewords to early poems from Don MacKay and John Hollander to speak to why to cover Al Moritz, and that is the particular selection of early poems, a little on the shorter side, and still an example of his style. And then also, he does have a lot of emotion that his poems bring out in the reader, in its expository style of describing and with the mixing of the metaphors, making you feel different emotions. And then also, he does have distinct measure in his style. It's not full lyric, it's not full expository, but he keeps a balance, a dynamic between the two, that we can see on the page some three lines per stanza consistently, or five, and similar numbers of syllables to line. And so, Don MacKay, I pull, quote, "Two things hit me at once when I read Al Moritz, a sense of shift, of incipient metamorphosis, which is everywhere in the poems, that mixing of metaphor, and feel of change. And second, an awareness that they are grounded in a deep intellectual and moral commitment. That, being what might be a little contradictory on the surface, but instead, quote, it's the consequence of the poet's profound anarchism, which denies the usual structures of knowing in the interests of opening a wider, phenomenal sense of the real. Reading these poems, we are always crossing between accepted realms of experience. In fact, often situated in that condition of betweenness, between thinking and dreaming. And so, what we have between each poem is something that has a blurred line between the dream world, something we might come to know as surreal, but still using seemingly regular language that we understand the individual words to. And because we have that sort of ease and calm, which is how I read Don MacKay's next quote, quote, when a person thinks of other radical romantics, Shelley, Rimbaud, the lesser known Hart Crane, it often seems that the poet's heroism is the real story, not the process of imaginative engagement, as is the case with the poetic arc, for example, in his arc poetry later on. It is not so much the birth of the exotic. And for MacKay, he says that yes, for those romantic poets, that birth of the exotic, absolutely, I love it. But with Al Moritz, it might be more a death of the banal. He's looking to take what seems ordinary and see that there's interest in everything. And so, you have what it becomes the title of his foreword, and this is the last of this main point, is that what poetry for him is a shipwreck. Always a shipwreck, and gives clear sight. You have something before you. Maybe it's in shallow water, and you're on top of it, looking at the details. But you also have a clear sight, because nothing's changing in this moment that you're experiencing these details. And maybe you have a clear look around you, deciding what to do next. And I don't think I have to go too far to pull you onto my side of the argument as well, that there's more to reality than just our senses. Perhaps one might say that the ego we are too involved with, and that for a real understanding, we need to go deeper into what you don't think of often, if at all, or even what you account for superlatively with your ego. And look no further than Freud with Anna O, let alone that the interpretation of dreams are 5 years later to establish. All you have to do is put it to words. Well, not all you have to do. But if you relate experiences that you didn't realize you were conceiving in a different way, if you put it to words, some language, you can overcome a laundry list of symptoms.
You know, Anna O is, I'm going to call her the mother of psychoanalysis. She was an analysand, or a patient, as she would have been called in the 19th century. And one day I'll talk at length about her. Not today, but I will point out she came up with the term the talking cure. And she felt she would be healthy as long as she could talk to her doctor every single day. That was Breuer, who knew Freud very well. I gotta say, when I'm approaching this poetry, which I know very little about, I know you read a couple poems while I was driving. I could kind of hear you, and you'll probably put it in better terms than me, but one of the main points of poetry, I think, is often one of the intended uses of it is something I don't use it for enough, which is the ability to like be relaxed by not needing to pin down language. As speaking beings every day, we are expected to say words that point to specific concepts or images that we're all supposed to understand, but that's not how language works. We all react to it differently. We all have different associations. And so sometimes you might read a poem that doesn't require you to find the right interpretation or signification. You can just enjoy it, which I rarely do. I'm always like, where's the politics? Where's the identities being fashioned or articulated? Where's the history in it? So today, after all the recent and current events of American politics, man, maybe I can just sit back and relax as we read a couple poems.
We will have a little more content from Hollander and McKay, but how about you read our first poem?
Yes.
This is Soft Body by A.F. Morris. Morning outfitted with a pun for demonstrative sorrow. You become me as falling inward, asleep from the heartfelt pounding of a blank expression covering the window looking in. You turn to a momentary failure to see this scene as beautiful as immense. Now the flight gropes, the mouth open to spews, desperate to swallow. I fell here to avoid the touch of wind, glances of stars on my shoulders. Now I find arms hugging curvature of earth, breast and landscape married along a glowing line. A head submerged and drinking the green light that changes an ocean. The embrace puts on huge garments of being viewed, one above the other, and the center of an eye opening on itself, we feel the first finger of its surprise as the break of ground toward blueprints all night thrashed out. These affairs fall on her and me from the way day returns and the eyes start seeing things. a matter of freedom as a sheet. The problem of what to make of woman locks entree to the immobile gate of bone, still soft body of morning. I'm going out into you, you to return me a hard light in the afternoon. And so, I think the best way to approach one of the aspects is to tease out the metaphors to best understand, to the extent one can, his poems. We have morning and the light, the moment he's creating for this poem, and perhaps a soft body beside him. A little reflection of himself as well appears, and then it blurs together into the morning itself, which he goes out into as he leaves for the morning. It is a bit of, I add here now, what John Hollander adds. You have something of the tradition of the Obad, and see no further than Philip Larkin's Obad or John Donne's To the Sun, I believe, for great examples. And he decides to make this strange one here. And yes, this is a good example of this merging of just a few metaphors and letting you think in a different way.
Yeah, it kind of mixes up two objects of the poem, which is either like the body of a lover or the landscape. And he says, breast and landscape married. I think that is a very clear claim of what he's doing here. Because I can't really tell whether he's talking about a woman or nature, and I think the only answer is both.
With Hollander, when speaking to soft body as a medieval obad in its form, its echo, quote, it acknowledges at the outset traditional ambivalence at the dawn of a new day, which signals both the end of night and the necessary departure of the speaker, the male lover. That morning outfitted with a pun for demonstrative sorrow. And in the course of the poem, morning becomes personified momentarily in the speaker himself and then in a female body. And so sometimes the answer can be all of the above. But this is a great time to make the point that if one gets a little confused as to what Moritz is trying to do, I might gently guide them towards, well, read the title of the poem. It's soft body. It's about the different metaphors he wants to use, about a soft body. Influences the experience of this moment.
These affairs fall on her and me. These affairs, I think, are the blueprints all night thrashed out. These affairs fall on her and me from the way day returns and the eyes start seeing things. So he's going off to work, I guess?
Yeah. Something like that.
So the last lines of the poem...
He has to leave. For whatever reason that day, he has
to
go.
Well, he says, I'm going out into you. You to return me a hard light in the afternoon. What's the hard light in the last line of the poem?
I take it as maybe you don't want to see it. It's right off the edge of the horizon blinding you.
Yeah. I almost want to read hard like firm or like... hard to bear, an intense light. Like, he's got to go and work in the daylight, perhaps. Either way, it's called soft body, but he's getting a hard light in the afternoon. So I'd like to say it's the opposite of everything he's talking about in The Ideal Lover. It's not something good.
I see.
But somehow he's talking about the morning in a very loving and tender way. Still soft body of morning. I'm going out into you, even though I know you're not going to treat me right come midday. Blind girl. How is the blind girl come here, deaf, without touch or taste or scent, voiceless, closed husk in a night of fog? Beautiful as sunken city, you make water from our ignorance. You are not one of those theaters an audience creates. Your body is grave. No news escapes it. And when awakening, the lightning stretches out its liquid wire of manganese. There are no earth and sky to form the gap it needs to leap, no wall in which the new light could be fissure. Suddenly, the vision of you is as good as dream. We move at once to the hotel of brick windows. Here, the social activity is intense, and at seldom night, the bored nerves of our eyes amuse themselves as formerly, assembling things like you on the empty dark.
Yes. So our metaphors? For our blind girl, a sunken city. The moment of time that they're in, as well as when awakening, the lightning stretches out its liquid wire of manganese, no earth and sky to form the gap. There's no direction, it can't go when you're blind. So the first line, how is it the blind girl come here? And perhaps even deaf, without touch, or taste, or sense, or scent. Even voiceless. In night.
So not only blind, but has no senses, am I right?
For the purposes of this poem.
Yeah.
How could she be here at night, beautiful as the sunken city? And so he is then imagining her. Suddenly the vision of you is as good as dream. And we move at once to the hotel of brick windows. And when, at night, the bored nerves of our eyes, I take that boring as wearing away, getting blinder, amuse themselves as formerly. There is a creation happening in the hotel, assembling things like you on the empty dark. And I take that, perhaps a little bit of a pause between assembling things, the creation of dream, like you, the blind girl on the empty dark. His dream is, I see it as projected onto a cave wall.
He says the vision of you is as good as dream. Not equivalent.
Is as good as dream.
It's not even a dream. It's as good. That could have two meanings, I think. It might be as good as dreaming, but it also might mean, it's almost like saying as good as gone. As good as not real. As much a fantasy as a dream. He says, you are not one of those theaters an audience creates. Your body is grave. No news escapes it. Well, that line is grave, I must say. It might be implying that she's dead or like the dead. Those associations are certainly there for most people who read this, I think. No news escapes it. So, my question is, does the blind girl have any experience, any news that she's keeping to herself? Or is she purely an object of this vision that has no experience of her own?
The idea of considering the creation of the remote possibilities of meaning is a direct quote of Moritz himself. As I read it right now, here is a quote in that context by John Hollander in his foreword, quote, in relation to the other faculties and disciplines, and he speaks to what is Morris's, this is by Don Mackay, and he speaks to what about the style of Moritz's poetry. That is, what he wants to do is the disordering of experience, that poetry comes in order to smash order and admit the real, to show that ordered experience has, in fact, a non-experience, an abstract existence within a schema, a shell. That is, we want to consider the remote, incarnating the remote possibilities. Because of what considering different angles, points of view, relations of the language, in order to experience what we would never otherwise do, just by putting a few words next to some others that would never otherwise be together, and break out of that shell.
Yeah, it makes sense, but loosely. It's not like they're random words.
Absolutely not, correct. There
and
is
that's what
intention.
I yeah, when I said it's relaxing to be able to say, hey, here's some meanings. I kind of see them there, but, you know, I can't really make up my mind about them, and that's okay.
I would now like to make another prepared point, that is, about his intentionality. That is, there is a careful choice of words, and to this same echo that Mackay refers to, I submit what I have spoken to perhaps before here, that of the work of Jackson Pollock, when he is using his drip technique, or painting, action painting, frenetic dances, to, in his words, see all angles of the canvas. You get works that one could say, oh, I could do that. But then that raises the question, do you want to? Pollock wanted to. And not all paintings of his are the same. One of his more famous ones, more known, number 17A, one of my preferred, is it's got color from side to side, top to bottom, filled in, and yet you also have the splashes, you have the drips from so many different angles that I think to the moment it was created and that experience, how many angles he was looking at his canvas for, what kind of dance was he doing?
Okay, what's the painting of?
And at least, and that is
just colors?
To the crux of the matter, it's just colors. And that is to ask the question, if you look
at
number 17A, and you see something, and this is to everyone, well, let me know, because I don't see anything. But I look at it, and I think about all those things, all those different aspects of what the experience of creating this painting for him was like, and everyone that is looking at this right now alongside that has seen it before. And have they seen something? I still don't.
Well, the people who'd see something, I mean, that's on them. Like, that's their associations. And I think there's a bit of an element of that in some poetry. A poet often leaves you filling in some gaps.
Absolutely.
So as a reader, you are in some sense a writer a lot of the time.
And paying close attention to his gaps, I think, is a great point, because that is precisely where he intends to, he's very deliberate in how he either measures his meter, which can be consistent sometimes in his early poetry, or how he chooses to break it and forces us to search for our own meaning. Here is full context for the quote of earlier. This is Don MacKay in relation to the other faculties and disciplines. Poetry acts as a kind of conscience, forever calling upon them to resist their tendency to calcify into concepts, or fall into one form or another of technological sleep, and return instead to the task of, quote-unquote, probing for reality. That reality is, and MacKay speaking, perhaps for Moritz, yes, that reality is telos, purpose, endpoint. And not the assumed foundation as a primary article of faith here. Reality is what the poem invokes, what it serenades, and what, by the poem's own live presence, is called into being. Quote unquote, incarnating that remote possibility. A poem is soft body. Is it so soft? After all, there's hard light at the end. Is it a body? It seems it's several bodies, including morning. Incarnating all the remote possibilities of what is actually happening in that poem. Or, for it being blind, well, they find their way in their in that last stanza to a hotel. And is it a girl? Well, perhaps that's more straightforward. But when it comes to the titles of all the poems, it's an interesting question to always ask. I love this. This is, He Would Have Coursed the Dough by A.F. Moritz. He would have coursed the dough across her body, but that night gave out on the frayed tapestry. The night whose horse had raised one foreleg on the bridge fading over the stream. The hunter with arrows sheathed and bow rigidly dangling as he looks back to castle walls. And the wary doe looks back far off along her body from the edge of a white pool. Though the hills, the fields at harvest, the silver entangled woods are flat, his eyes of yarn won't see her where she listens, paused to drink. It's a description of a deer, a doe, and a hunter. and language plays too. He could have coursed the doe, shot the doe across her body, but that knight gave out on the frayed tapestry. The rug of the knight that I take is torn. Perhaps in emotional state, the knight whose horse had raised one foreleg on the bridge fading over the stream. And I simply take this as the horse is at peace. And the stream to give this element of constant change. The hunter with arrows sheathed and bow rigidly dangling as he looks back to castle walls. What's on his mind? Maybe not so much the deer, what's happening back at the castle walls. Or what's within. And so his arrows are sheathed, despite his bow being rigidly right, ready to go. He does not get the bow, or get the doe. Even though, well, as she is at the white water and has the awareness to look across her body, along her body, as she looks back.
Well, she's looking at a reflection, right?
Perhaps. I think of it as looking with their flexible neck back towards where perhaps the doe sees the hunter, but does not move. And thus does not get shot.
Oh, looks back along her body, from the edge of a white pool. My favorite line is where she listens, paused to drink. So she doesn't really seem to feel in danger. And she's not in danger. The guy misses and he sheathes his bow. She listens, paused to drink.
So I think an interesting question among the many. Does he see the deer? I simply imagine I don't think he does, but he might. Or that he missed. Does he shoot? I wasn't sure. I don't think he does, because he didn't see. But it's so short. It's just descriptive. It makes you think. To fill in the details, to make a story, which is just not his style.
Yeah, I see it now. Yeah, he did. He's sheathing his bow because he doesn't see the prey. He's busy looking back, saying, I want to be home. Could have got home with a beautiful doe. But he's not being a good hunter is all. We can't pity this guy. From here, 1975. Life of determination. Once wandering people of excremental sorrow in these valleys winding out of mists into watery days, behind them the mazy river of their progress is pocked with highlights by the permanent sunset. They play a music too regular to hear. They listen instead to the birds, and their daughters add syllables addressing the conch-like ear of whirlpool or wind devil. Mother taught me my name, womb. Though for many years I understood this word to be wound. And now you tell me my ever-regenerated decay is health and beauty, now that I can't remember if you were the fatal knife or became one in answer to this hole filled with blood. And always at these pleas of faithless love, their distant husbands are terrified. The landscape will blow away. The husbands modify their sullen rush to a sullen stillness, make themselves stone to wait earth down and anchor it, and the fires imprisoned grow angry at the first shock and then cooler. Thus, wastes solidify, society, the alternative of nature, becomes complex and satisfying, and no longer is felt the humiliating need to leave the filthy camps behind for the legend of cleanliness. They have made virtue from necessity, inventing a history, erecting towers to guard their soft wives from the outlaw brother, Cain or Proteus, he who comes to the wall all summer in the forms of every bird assaulting the blood with a changeless infinity of calls. How he probes them with his contentment, the one thing needful in the bird-like determination of this life, sexual spring. Huddle of silent feathers under snow.
And yes, the metaphors we have here are of decay and growth. And we have a child speaking to her mother, or rather, sorry, yes, they listen instead to the birds, their daughters, at syllables, addressing the conch-like ear of Whirlpool or Wind Devil. Ah, so perhaps no one in particular is this directed to Whirlpool or Wind Devil, to torrential images of violent change. Mother taught me my name, and so, and always at these pleas of faithless love, their distant husbands are terrified.
And what's the name? Womb. So they're defined by being a future mother, I suppose. And they thought this word meant...
the source of creation.
Yeah, they thought this word meant wound.
And so, with distant husbands terrified, they weigh down the landscape as stones, heavy objects, anchor it, and then the fires, imprisoned, grow angry at the first shock and then cooler. Things become traditional, normal. Wastes solidify, bordering comical at times, as Moritz. Society, the alternative of nature, becomes complex and satisfying. Things beyond what you're going to be able to fully comprehend on a given day, but yet you might be happier, and no longer is felt the humiliating need to leave the filthy camps for the legend of cleanliness. And they are these...
this is like a birth of civilization story.
And these husbands, erecting towers, guard their soft wives from their outlaw brother, Cain or Proteus, biblical figure, and then the Greek figure, as well as Shakespeare echo.
We know him in Shakespeare, a very strange and very oftentimes thought to be very misogynistic play, where Proteus is not the greatest guy. He actually tries to assault his best friends, like beloved. And then his best friend basically, in many interpretations, gives her to him to be married anyway. So, whether it's ancient or in the Shakespearean telling or in the biblical telling of Cain, protection is needed.
And as the poem is of life of determination at the very end, well, yet, in our determined way, like a bird, we will huddle like silent feathers under snow, waiting our time.
I love the idea of bird-like determination. And it's about getting laid.
It's also about birds.
Sexual,
it's also,
spring.
But every poem is about many things. There's always...
well, this one, he very much says sexual spring. Yeah. So, as someone who studies psychoanalysis, I think more poems are about sex than you would think. But this one's very clear that at the end, it's all about sex. I mean, this is just kind of like a phantasmal story. This is just a fun vision of what, you know, no one has ever known, which is, you know, the actual birth of creating walls and guarding women. But these girls still get a lovely voice. Womb or wound, as she thought. And now you tell me my ever regenerated decay is health and beauty. Now that I can't remember if you were the fatal knife or became one in answer to this hole filled with blood. I wouldn't say this is a happy story. But it's got determination, and it's got cuddling at the end.
I love this next poem. Reunion by A.F. Moritz. Once we existed by violence, but now we are in gardens such as these. The fear of entropy is banished to the kitchen. The back chambers and passages where our help gossips and tastes the leavings of the party. What could we do in our first blind rush but take the arroyos constructed in the desert by long fled water and cover their lips with moss? In that city of neon lights and dust, the wooden poles were the lobby's potted palms in the Hotel des Bains, through which you slipped to avoid me for another love you knew was light and dust. This is the sorrow that answers our questions here among conversations and violins, the shame of our old impossibility, that we hug, each alone, over which we laugh, assured now that should everything withdraw, we still would spin through darkness, two seeds in their husks. And so, what we have in this scene is, well, the question always to think at first, is it a reunion? Well, we know by the end, it's not. They are two seeds in their husks at this moment, and then we must read again in order to realize. The reunion is in the thinking of what was, our old impossibility, which he says is a shame, perhaps because it's also the potential. What could have been? Once we existed by violence, but now we are in gardens such as these. It's not terrible, he's still in gardens. The fear of entropy is banished to the kitchen, the black chambers and passages, where our help gossips. I take that as help, that the economy of people, maybe there's someone
gossips
waiting on them
tastes.
At a restaurant kind of situation, and tastes the leavings of the party, maybe a server or someone administering a party. What could we do in our first blind rush? Arroyos constructed in the desert with neon lights. I take it to be Vegas, perhaps. And then maybe they got one of those famous marriages. And of course, we're not talking about Moritz himself. It's just one of his poems. He loves doing this, speaking for other people. And in the city of neon lights and dust, the wooden poles with the lobby's potted palms in the Hotel des Bains, through which you slipped to avoid me for another love you knew was light and dust. And he's left to think, well, perhaps it's what she might have thought of me too, but nonetheless, that last stanza, it's still a sorrow that answers our questions here, because it could have been something among conversations and violins. Maybe another party. That's when this last stanza is thinking of.
My goodness, the shame of our old impossibility that we hug each alone, over which we laugh. We laugh at ourselves for hugging each other in fantasy when we're not with each other, and it's just sad when we happen to cross paths at a party among conversations and violins.
Yes. It could actually be that last stanza. They have, and there's a bit of evidence of reunion. They see each other again among the conversations and violins.
And there's a very direct conclusion after that moment in this last stanza. They are assured now that should everything withdraw, we still would spin through darkness, two seeds in their husks. So they know that under the best circumstances, they would still just drift apart alone with a barrier around them, each of them. It's kind of like saying, well, it's a nice thought, but that's all it is a thought.
Yes.
It's a very calm, collected speaker Moritz has given us. But I don't think we can really trust this speaker when they try to give the impression that it's sorrow and that it's a shared sorrow, because they don't talk. The beloved or the object of desire perhaps, or of fantasy, slips through the lobby. And it says, to avoid me for another love you knew was light and dust. So maybe, I mean, who knows? This could be some stalker, like, who's got this crazy fantasy. I mean, that's a bit extreme. But the point is, I mean, if she's, or he, or they are sneaking around, they can't be romanticizing their impossibility to the degree that the speaker is. Well, they could be, but it's not as likely. So these poems really activate your imagination. Every one of them. They make you fill in parts of stories that are missing. And they make you accept the undecidability of what these characters are like, what they want, who they're talking to, or what they're talking to, allowing us to think all contradictory options are possible at once, seemingly contradictory. And so sometimes we just need that moment to relax, I think, and not pin down an interpretation. It is quite soothing, isn't it?
Yes, well, we are among those that can take soothing in open questions as well.
Surprised myself a little bit.
Not needing to put in all the details to make it a story. And still come back to it another time and then make it another story, considering on how the language reads at that moment.